Kyungwon and I met where the farm fields ended, and our refugee village began. I waited until my little brother was asleep, until I could count 7 seconds between his uneasy inhales. I listened as Hyunki's breath struggled through the thick scum in his lungs. If he coughed, I'd stay and take care of him. On those nights, I imagined Kyungwon waiting for me by the lamppost, with cigarette butts scattered in a halo around his feet. Everyone in our village whispered what they wanted to believe. The war would end, and we would return to our real home soon. Mother and the other aunties chattered in the market. They had survived 35 years of Japanese rule and the Second World War. They had withstood the division of our Korea by foreign men. What was a little fighting among our own compared to past misfortune? "We can stitch ourselves back together," Mother said. I believed her. When Hyunki's breathing was steady and slow, I slipped out through the kitchen entrance and went in search of Kyungwon. He and I were celebrating. We celebrated every night. A year ago, when the 625 war between the North and South began, everyone in my country fled, propelled by confusion and news in the form of unexpected sounds, bullets, airplanes, the cries of the dying. The mothers, daughters, elders, and children of my hometown stampeded south, hitching ourselves onto trains, scrabbling up mountains, wading through paddies and treading rivers. Mother, Hyunki, and I wore white and carried loads on our backs and on our heads. We walked until we reached the southeasternmost tip of our peninsula, where shelters gathered around markets and landmarks to form crude villages. All along the coast, people I knew from childhood lived crammed up against strangers. Most settled in the center of Busan, where houses and churches and schools and salvaged structures packed the streets. Refugees thronged together as tight as bean sprouts, as if closeness and the East Sea equaled protection. Mother separated us from the others, planting us farther out in the fields, away from the ocean and its currents. She said it was foolish to live so close together.
"They'll be killed clean in one day if the Reds come, swept into the sea like a pile of dead fish."
She often spoke of luck and what happened in its absence. We were lucky to have been among the first wave of refugees. We were lucky her great-uncle had died soon after our arrival, so we could claim his straw-roofed home as our own. It was small and time-worn, but less fortunate families sheltered beneath scraps of steel. We were lucky the others, displaced and adrift, had not dared to crowd us out, and lucky to have found this place where life persisted, where news of fighting arrived on leaflets but didn't yet invade our days. I felt lucky for nothing except my nightly distractions, for Kyungwon, whom I had known since childhood, and his desire to erase my fears and our secret hours together. I arrived through the field to find Kyungwon waiting. He blew a stream of smoke in my direction, and the clouds curled toward me, hazy and warm. I breathed in their bitter scent.
"What took so long?" he asked.
"Hyungi's sick again." I grabbed the cigarette from his lips. "It took him a while to fall asleep." He nodded at the hanbok I wore.
"You still want to go?"
Would I chance coming out here for no reason? I blew a smoke ring in the dim glow of the lamppost. His gaze lingered on my long wraparound skirt and short jacket top. I shrugged. "I don't want to wear the men's pants anymore. We'll be careful."
"I don't know."
He stared at the road connecting our market to the other makeshift villages.
"What if someone catches us?"
"No one will hear us if we're quiet." I started toward his bicycle, partially hidden behind the thick barley. "Let's go."
"We'll head east," he said, catching up to me. "Found some extra money this time.
Can we buy food? I'm so hungry I sucked on one of Hyungi's tree roots today." Kyungwon held the bicycle steady as I scooted onto the handlebars.
"We'll see,"